We're joined today by my colleague and friend Megan Bond. Megan is the chair of the DFL Environmental Caucus and has considerable experience and knowledge pertaining to the environmental movement in general, environmental issues in Minnesota, and in particular, issues that are most relevant in her own front yard in the far northern reaches of the North Star State. Megan is a lawyer, and she lives in International Falls up on the Canadian border. Megan, welcome to the podcast. I want to know, how did you originally get into the environmental movement to begin with?
So it kind of happened by happenstance, just an internship I fell into through, friend back in high school and college working for the Las Vegas Valley Water District and Southern Nevada Water Authority. And it was really just during when we had this horrible population boom. I don't want to say the population boom was horrible, but we had a big population boom that led to like an extreme use of water in the Colorado River and the Colorado River Basin, and just how the Colorado River was allocated. So if you have been paying attention, it's all over, international news. Lake Mead, which was the world's largest man-made lake for a long time, is now dry. It's like a river, right? It's like a creek in some areas, I feel like. And even just the past few years, it's just gotten worse and worse. So I really kind of worked on like that, which was, like I said, it was more on the internship avenue, but it really just did get me into the public policy end of the environmental movement. And then just wherever I've been, I've kind of found myself into it, whether it was Southern California or here or in Minnesota. Well, right now I'm in Las Vegas, so I say here in Nevada.
Here in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm visiting some family. So, so whether it's been here in Las Vegas or out in California when I lived there, and then when I moved up to Minnesota, a couple of years into law school, I just found myself getting back involved in it too. I was on the Environmental Law Society for all three, board of the Environmental Law Society for all 3 years of law school. And then I kind of, and like you were talking about like science-based everything, my actual educational background is actually in healthcare administration, healthcare policy. That's what I did in undergrad and focused in law school and when I was doing my master's degree too. And so that's another science overlap. And then the environmental movement, healthcare, brings a lot of the public health issues into play too. So that's been a big passion of mine when dealing with like clean air. Mm-hmm. And then when I started getting involved at the DFL, it just kind of naturally was a fit. And I'd known some people that are involved in our caucus and on our board from prior nonprofits and activism work I'd done with the environmental movement in Minnesota, like when I was working for Voyageurs National Park Association and doing some work with Friends of the Boundary Waters, was a good ally of ours, and MCEA, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. So basically when I was with Voyageurs, which is now Voyageurs Conservancy, really started falling into that, meeting a lot of allies, including Kristen Larson, who's on our board. So I've known Kristen for a long time, and Lawrence and Sandy Sandoval too.
Okay. Now this is an international podcast. In that
okay.
I think we have at least one listener in Australia.
Wow.
And so I want to add some information. The DFL, Minnesota is a state.
It is.
People on the coast don't necessarily know that. I remember when I was a kid being confused. I thought
right.
Omaha was a state and Minnesota was a city. But they were both in the same place. And all I knew about it was Omaha, neutral to Omaha, from watching Marlon Perkins TV show.
Watching the TV show, yeah.
And we would hear news every winter a few times from your city where you live, International Falls. We'd hear about it a few times a year.
Right.
When you would break the record cold for that day.
Yeah.
So, and the DFL means the Democratic Party in Minnesota.
Yeah. So Las Vegas is a city in the state of Nevada,
right.
Towards the southern part. When I was in Southern California, I kind of lived all over LA County, Los Angeles County, and then in Orange County too, just south of that. So, and then I moved to Minneapolis, which is a city in the state of Minnesota.
Right.
And now I live in International Falls, which is a town, I'll call it a town. I don't know if it's quite a city, up in on the Canadian border of North Central Minnesota. And, they've got the nickname, the icebox of the nation, because we frequently break records for low temperatures and such things, negative 55, and with real fuel without wind chill. And that's negative 55 Fahrenheit. It is very close to negative 55 Celsius. Around the time you get to negative 40, both Fahrenheit and Celsius, the numbers start to almost match up.
Right, and it
So,
hardly matters anymore at that point
and at that
anyway.
point, you're just staying inside
Yeah.
anyway.
Yeah. And that is the nearest American thermometer to the Arctic Circle outside of Alaska,
Is that we used
probably.
to have a
Well,
big thermometer. It's not there anymore, but
really do say.
right. But it's also the gateway community to Voyageurs National Park, which is
Right.
Minnesota's only national park.
Right. And that's key. And it's just worth noting that in Minnesota, we call everything a city. Like if you go list, like everything is technically a city. And there are something like 450 cities in Minnesota, and the 30 smallest ones have zero people in them.
Right. And so, yeah, because there is this like League of Minnesota Cities or whatever with that. But having grown up in a town of or in a city that started out as about less than 500,000, that's now close to 2, and then moving to the biggest city in America, and then ending up in Minneapolis, which is LA,
Right.
ending up in Minneapolis, which is another 500,000,
Right.
I consider International Falls a town.
So you have
Yeah.
interesting perspectives then on the geography of our species as it fills spaces and takes up resources and stuff.
Everything from like
Yeah.
suburban sprawl to cramped cities to
Yeah.
small towns, yeah.
At the University of Nevada in Las Vegas,
Nevada.
Nevada, there's a my parents lived there for years, but they don't think they even know how to pronounce it. But
It happens.
the there's a a history museum at the university, or there used to be a history museum at the university
Okay.
anyway. And they had an exhibit on water many, many years ago when I first went out there to visit my parents when they moved out. So this would have been in the 80s or something. And
Okay.
they showed a postcard that had been produced in the early days when Las Vegas was a town. Like nobody lived there yet. And
Right.
before casinos, everything, nothing had happened
Yeah.
there yet. They
Yeah,
wanted to bring.
casinos didn't really come around until the early 30s.
Yeah. And this is back. It might have even been called something different than Las Vegas. It might have been Silver City or something. I don't. I probably was lost. Anyway, there was a postcard that you were supposed to send east to your friends to get them to come out, and it showed a touched up photograph, like those old fashioned photographs. It's actually a photograph, but it's also touched up to make it look fancy. And it's got all these geysers coming out of the ground, and it's where some real estate developers went out and poked down near the lake, where it's now where the reservoir is, down near the reservoir. Maybe even under the reservoirs, I don't know. They poked these holes in the ground and artesian wells popped out
Okay.
and ran for weeks or months, showing how much water there was here. Unfortunately, they had tapped into the aquifer and emptied it. So
Okay.
then it was done. So nobody could build
Yeah.
their developments and put wells down because the wells would be dry and they wouldn't have been. There was probably a decade of water there just under the surface. You know,
That
our
they
kid,
just
they just
blew.
threw it out.
Yeah,
But
there's a place called the Las Vegas Springs Preserve. It's was set up by the Water District, and it's pretty cool. And I'm not going to get into it, but if people want to Google it does have to do with some of the original groundwater that they found in Las Vegas, and it's right in the center of the city.
yeah, I think I've been there at some point. So you ended up you and so you, why did you get into law? Not that's what this podcast is about, but is there a connection to the environment and law here for you?
No,
No,
I
okay.
just went to law school. It's something I wanted to do. As you're making career choices when you're younger, it's kind of where I was headed and thought so for probably since middle school. And of course, you waver and not, but eventually, going all the way through college, it was decided that that's what I wanted to do was go to law school, and then took a few years off after college, and worked, and then went to law school. That was just a career path I chose a long time ago.
Yeah. So there must not be a lot of lawyers in International Falls.
There's a handful of us.
Handful, yeah.
There's I think like four practicing full time and a couple practicing part time, and then the judge and the county attorney and the assistant county attorney.
Is International Falls a county seat?
Yes.
Okay. So that helps you because you kind of
And
live near the county seat.
right. Well, and it's interesting about Couchiching County is that's where the county International Falls is in, is it's two-thirds wetlands. So trying to build and expand is difficult. It's Couchiching's actually the second largest county in the state of Minnesota next to St. Louis, which is the county right next door. And that's like where the Mesabi Iron Range, most of the Boundary Waters, Canoe Area Wilderness, and then City of Duluth, are in St. Louis County, and that's like the biggest county, I think, east of the Mississippi River as well.
Yeah.
So it's pretty big, but it's two-thirds wetlands, and it's only about 13,000, excuse me, God, not 13 million, remember that people in some 13,000 people that live there. So it's rural.
Can you explain to our listeners what the Boundary Waters is?
So back in the 60s and 70s, there was an advocacy group. And so in the Superior National Forest, which is a huge national forest in northern Minnesota, they developed a chunk of it. They took about 1 million acres and just made it complete wilderness area. And so it's known as a recreation area, but you can't take a motorboat in there. So everybody goes in there by canoe or kayak, typically canoes. And there's just like, I don't even know how many lakes. I say there's like 100, but I don't honestly couldn't tell you the exact number of lakes. And they just canoe around and portage and camp. And they're pretty strict on mechanical stuff. You can't have a bicycle. I think you can have a bicycle in certain parts of it, but there's a group that really advocates for a lot of the hiking there. But it's just a complete wilderness area. You don't have cell phone service. And it's just nice to get out there and quiet and camp. And then right above it is Quetico, which is the Canadian version of it. And you're going to see even fewer campsites and people and stuff. So it's really, and then to the west of it is Voyageurs National Park. And so you're going to see a lot of the same flora and fauna, rocks and stuff like that as you see in the Boundary Waters. But instead of having like 100 little lakes, we have five big ones. And then several little lakes on the interior. But when I say several, I think there's like seven. On the
Yeah,
interior peninsula. And the interior peninsula, the Cabotogama Peninsula, is what they call proposed wilderness area. So it's treated like wilderness area, like the Boundary Waters.
Okay. And could you tell us what are the main threats to this area right now? I guess I should just mention quickly, this Lake Superior is the world's largest freshwater entity.
Yes, there it
And
is the world's, yeah, the top five are the United States Great Lakes. Well, the United
it's
States and Canadian Great
yeah,
Lakes.
it's biggest of the Great Lakes. It's the deepest, coldest, cleanest, biggest, and wettest of the Great Lakes. You keep mentioning that the area in your county is wetland, most of it, or a lot of it. That's actually true to some extent in much of Minnesota. The southern part, not so much, but much of Minnesota is. But when I worked in the rainforest with the FAA Pygmies, I made a discovery, a couple of discoveries, but one of them was that the pathways they took, although they're perfectly straight paths and they don't seem to do anything winding around, they strategically avoid almost all wetlands to avoid having to walk through a marsh. And also, they're kind of dangerous for other reasons. Like, they're literally as quicksand there. Like in the old Tarzan movies, that part's real. You can fall into a hole,
Oh,
have
the
a hard time
never-ending
getting out.
story. That was the
You
saddest thing
can
ever.
get out. It's not so bad. But if you went off trail in the interior forest, you don't walk into a wetland within 300 meters. Okay. And that's actually true of Minnesota. If you are drive people drive along, there's pine trees and spruce trees and maple trees, and you think it's all nice woodlands. But if you leave the road in any of the northern counties, you find yourself in a mire or a swamp or a wetland pretty
Very
much right
much so.
away. As if you got past a ditch, which is next to the road. That whole area is all this water. And all that water that's in Lake Superior goes through that land on the way to Lake Superior through dozens of rivers that flow over the edge, right?
In the St. Louis Wa County, in the St. Louis River watershed, that's true. But as you get a little further north, it actually is, you're above the Laurentian Divide, and the curvature of the earth goes that way and goes north. And so a lot of what the Rainy River watershed is, which is what encompasses the majority of the Boundary Waters, all of Voyageurs National Park, and then into Lake of the Woods, which is one of the biggest water, it's one of the biggest watersheds in the world, actually. If you look at a map of the United States, you see about this much, but in all actuality, it goes way up into Canada, which is huge. And eventually it flows into Lake of the Woods and then up the river into Lake Winnipeg, and it'll eventually end up in the Hudson Bay and the Arctic Ocean. It's the water, that's where we are.
Right. So that's a huge amount. And
It's
then
a huge
and
amount.
there's a little area on the rest of the state flows into the upper is in the is the upper Mississippi.
Is the upper Mississippi or the Lake Superior watershed?
Yeah. So
And
yeah.
then,
So there's some point in the state where if you dump some water in the ground, it could go to the Arctic, it could go to the Gulf of Mexico, or it could go to the Atlantic.
Exactly. Yeah, it's right kind of, and it's in St. Louis County, just north of the Mesabi Iron
Is it?
Range.
Okay. So this is an area where when we do things, when we humans do things that are messy, we have a chance of ruining just a huge percentage of the world's
Yeah, a
water.
huge percentage of it. Yeah.
Right. So what are the threats up there?
Okay, well, there's a few. I know the one you want to get to is a big one, but I'll touch on some small ones first. First and foremost, we're having huge global warming issues up here, climate change, with the fish are swimming deeper because the water temperature is warming, which is going to be terrible, and it's going to deplete the fish supply, which is a huge part of recreation up here. And then that's causing some really toxic algae blooms as well. So those are huge threats to the area, just based on the larger picture of climate change that's really drastically changing the scope of where we are. Another one that's coming up right now is a huge project that there's two, now there's three, four that they're trying to propose throughout the state. But the two that are big is they're these sulfide mining, copper nickel sulfide mining projects. And basically, we have a huge supply in what's known as the Duluth Complex, which goes way far south, even south of Lake Superior. And that's what they want to tap into with what's called the PolyMet NorthMet project. And then in the Rainy River watershed, which is just to the next one, and that's the one that's above the Laurentian Divide, and that encompasses most of the boundary waters and all of Voyageurs National Park, it has, excuse me, it's called Twin Metals. And that's the same kind of project. The mineral deposits there are, I don't think, are as rich as they are in the Duluth complex, or even if they are rich, that they're just not as big as they are in the Duluth complex. And I'm gonna just say to Google or look up Duluth complex, so because just for the sake of time. And they want to tap into these two things. Problem is, it's never been done safely. And there have been just some really disastrous results from it. And we can just start with some of the bad actors, as they're called. And that's the fact that Glen PolyMet is actually owned by a company called Glencore out of Switzerland, which has just a horrible reputation for just doing, going into small villages, having human rights violations, just tearing up their villages and stuff like that. And we're talking, South America, Africa, Russia, China, places that don't have any environmental protections in their countries for a wide variety of reasons. And then the other company is that's doing the twin that wants to do the Twin Metals project is Antofagasta, and they're out of Chile. They have a similar reputation to Glencore when it comes to things like that. They're two separate mines. Twin Metals wants to be a below ground mine and do a they don't want to be have a pit for their tailings. They want to do a pile. And then PolyMet's going to be an above ground mine, kind of more the similar ones that you see as iron ore mines, taconite mines. And they want to have a pit for their tailings, a tailings basin. So it's two watersheds, two projects, but one similar threat. That's a big one that's happening right now. That's been working on it. And the thing is, and these are interesting projects, you can look up the Mount Polly outside of Vancouver. That was just a horrendous, horrendous project. It's still that they've managed to get it back up and operational a little bit, but the groundwater there is just completely destroyed. People can't have wells or anything like that for potable water. And then in Brazil a few years ago, the dam collapsed, and it's the same dam that they want to put in as the PolyMet project. And that dam collapse, I think, was responsible for the loss of about 240 lives. So these are big threats up there right now. Fortunately, a lot of the environmental advocates have just been amazing. Between Friends of the Boundary Waters groups, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Water Legacy, a few other groups have really been just really stepping up and taking the lead. Duluth for Clean Water is another one on the litigation and stuff on these, trying to fight the permitting, trying to fight the environmental assessment, environmental impact statement that had to be done. in order to get the PolyMet project and then the permits. And as it turns out, there's quite a few scandals that came out of the State Department of Natural Resources, excuse me, in issuing some of these permits. And so that's been really tied up in litigation. They've been doing a very successful job of getting several of those permits overturned as they're going through the court system. Twin Metals is on federal land, so that's a little bit different in that the state DNR says they're going to do their own environmental impact statement on it, but it really is tied up with the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. Bureau of Land Management's within the Department of Interior, U.S. Forest Service is within the Department of Agriculture. So what's been good about that one is with the changeover in presidential administrations recently, at the end of the Obama administration, they revoked their lease renewals, which they should have been done long ago. They should have never renewed. And then the Trump administration promptly reinstated them. And the Biden administration has gone back and taken them away. And they're through a 2-year environmental assessment, peer review environmental assessment that the Trump administration had canceled. So that is kind of the situation in a nutshell, in broad pictures. And so, yeah, we've been working on those for, what year is it, 2022? 14 years, different organizations have been working on these projects and trying to really, stop them before they start.
Excellent summary. I actually learned it from that summary some things. And you and I are both members of the you're the chair of the DFL Environmental Caucus, which does environmental advocacy within the Democratic Party within Minnesota.
Yes.
And I'm a member of that caucus on the board as well.
Yes.
But when I joined it a few several years ago, I really knew nothing about any of this. My entire interest is in energy transition and climate change, and I learned all about the mining and the problems of the mining as a member of that caucus. And even that talk just now gave me some more information. It's worth noting that there are three or four events that happen, just like the Selma Bridge is known as a key moment in the equal rights movement in the United States. There's a few key moments that are noted as the origins, the multiple, but around the same time origins of the environmental movement. And one of those moments was having to do with iron mining and where they were putting the tailings on the North Shore. And so mining in Minnesota has been a driving force in the environmental movement in the past, since it
Yes.
started.
And yeah, and it still is because there is a lot of with the tailings basins and things that go out and they're effluent discharge, a lot of permits are required that too. And you can look up TMDL, the total daily maximum load, as well as some other discharges that go into that. The thing is we have some native wild rice up here. It's a type of rice. It's very good if you ever eat it. You need some salt, though. It's pretty bland, but it works really well
It's got a
in
really nice
things.
nutty flavor, though. It's
It's
really
got a
good.
really nice nutty flavor, but just add some salt and you can cook it with so many things. It's so good and it's good for you. And it was really sacred to the Native American population up here in the Ojibways. And right now, a lot of these wild rice that grows in our lakes up here, isn't safe to eat because of a lot of the discharge is not being monitored or enforced in a lot of these iron ore mines. Having said that, it is iron ore mining, which really boomed up here during World War II, and a lot of people consider the Mesabi Iron Range to have been a huge savior to World War II because of the fact that so many people were able to work in the factory and really increase the equipment for our military forces in during World War II. But it's been a boom and bust industry, and Nevada is a mining state as well, mostly silver and other types of ore. And I mean, just drive through the Western United States, and not just Nevada, but you can find it in Arizona and California too. These boom towns are now tourist attractions because they'd come, they'd extract everything out, and they'd leave. Difference is, you come out here to Nevada, we got very little groundwater, especially in the southern and central parts of the state. As you move up, you get more, but you're in a different water basin up then too, and you're in the Great Basin at that point. And that, but like, so it's just completely different. It's a completely different type of mining that they want to do. And so this type of extraction has never been done in as water rich of an area as northern Minnesota, because it's one of the most water groundwater rich areas. I think it is the most groundwater rich area in the United States, and it's, I think, number five in the world. Don't quote me on that. That might be something you want to check into, but it's an incredibly groundwater rich area. As I said, my own county is two-thirds wetlands. So, there's a lot of hesitation towards it for obvious reasons, because of the fact that we have these protected wilderness areas and Lake Superior, all like we talked about, all along the north shore of Lake Superior into Lake Superior, the Boundary Waters Wilderness, the tons of wetlands that are in Superior National Forest, and then into Voyageurs National Park. And something they've been saying with we had a Voyageurs Conservancy had a study done by a brilliant geologist named hydrologist named I think he's a geologist named Tom Myers, and he's worked out of the University of Nevada, Reno, and now the University of Montana. We had some overlap in career paths, but we never met. It was interesting. And then, I mean, if there's a major disaster breakout of Twin Metals, that stuff's going to go 100 miles, which will take it into Canada.
And there is, by the way, because it just started and we don't know much about it yet, because you're talking about the Superior drainage and Hudson Bay Arctic drainage, the Tamarack mines are also copper mines proposed for very nearby, but it just happens to be over the divide into the Mississippi River.
It does. It does. That one's new. And oh, you know what? I skipped a huge part of this that I should have said. W during this extraction, it produces sulfur. That's what they said, copper, nickel, sulfur mining. When sulfur mixes with water, it creates sulfuric acid, which turns your water that copper color, and it's just complete poison at that point. Now, the Tamarack is new, and that's further south near like what they call Aitkin County, and they want to pull a bunch of stuff out of there, and they're saying that what they really want out of there is the nickel
Yeah, more nickel.
for electric cars. So they're trying to get Elon Musk and Tesla on board for helping with the Tamarack mine, because they want the nickel for electric cars. Let's just say this: there is enough copper and nickel in the world without needing to tap into these resources.
It's something that when I first started learning about this, I looked into it and I pretty closely and the actual geology, because I do have some geology training. And I was surprised to see the numbers of how much copper and nickel there is in these deposits. But it's very little per unit area. They're very large. The thing is, the deposits are extensive. They're
Yes, they
sort of
are.
flat, very thin, flat formations that dive into the earth at a fairly steep angle. So we don't know how far they go, but they go beyond our reach. But they are the density of copper and nickel, and there's also titanium and a tiny bit of gold. The density of these minerals is so low that you'd have to mine a lot to get them, to get out enough to make it worthwhile. And there are other, I mean, the thing is, we don't recycle copper to speak
We
of,
don't.
a little.
We're at about a third of the copper recycling as they do in the EU, in Europe.
We salvage some, but we don't really do any systematic
We don't
recycling.
really do anything. And also, and this is just a family friend who, my husband calls him the copper pirate. He works for a company that travels the world and salvages copper. He and I got into a conversation at a Christmas party when you were both in town a few years ago, and he's like, "It is the most unnecessary mine." He's like, "It's just unnecessary. There's plenty out there.
Plus,
It's just a matter of getting it." You get into these conversations, and this is a very divisive issue where I live, and especially kind of south and to the east of where I live as well, where there's been done a lot of mining. They don't do mining in the county I live in. We just have a national park that's downstream of where they want to do all this mining. And one of the national park actually has a borders Canada to the lake. Three of the lakes are like actually two-thirds in Canada, a third in the United States. Rainy Lake, what I live on, I think it's the 53rd largest body of water, fresh water. It's huge. It's huge. There's a this issue has very been divisive amongst even within our political party, within the Democratic Party up north, in that mining's always been our way of life. Mining produces jobs, ancillary jobs, direct jobs. Well, this type of mining is going to be a boom and bust mining. It's not sustainable like some of the other mining they are doing up there. And the one of the reasons they use is all of a sudden these people who and have never really given a hoot about climate change before, aside from acknowledging that it exists, want to call those of us who are the environmental activists that are trying to protect our waters against this threat, kind of hypocrites for saying that we're not willing to extract this for the use of wind turbines and such.
Right.
And it's kind of like, okay, but the other thing is going into this, there's air permits, there's effluent discharge permits, there's all these other, there's dig all I can't even there's I don't know so many permits. I'm not gonna list them. But all of these, starting with the air pollution, the effluent discharge or TMDLs, is going to affect t climate change. It's every little bit. It's not just our, switching out of coal and onto renewables. It's not just, getting off your gasoline powered truck that gets 12 miles to the gallon and finding something that's more fuel efficient, hybrid or electric. It's not just putting solar panels on your house. It's a lot of things. And this is going to cause significant amount of air and water pollution. And at that point, that's all amounts to climate change. And we're already seeing huge effects for it in the Rainy River watershed, both in the Boundary Waters, Voyageurs National Park, Lake of the Woods, all the way into the Boreal. It's just not what it used to be, obviously.
So it sounds, I think that people were can be a little hopeful that in with recent, at least for the next few years, we might be seeing more. There's been successes in fighting the copper mining,
There
and
has,
we
yeah.
may see that developing further. What are any other environmental issues that you are concerned with statewide, in particular up where you live?
Up where I live, both the Boundary Waters and Voyageurs National Park are what they call Class One Clean Air Act areas, meaning we're supposed to have pristine visibility. Now, we would love to have that all over the world, right? Ideally. But what we get is regional haze, and it comes from a couple of coal-fired power plants, Clay Boswell and Sherco, and one of the mines on the North Shore. We've tried because the prevailing wind, it doesn't matter. And so we're trying to get that done because, and then it's a twofer in the fact that we can get that shut down, get those coal plants shut down and start moving to renewables. And I don't want to say let's shut down power plants, put people out of their jobs, anything like that. But at the same time, we need to make that shift and we need to start making that shift quickly. So that's affecting air quality up here. We've been in litigation of it before and that was not successful, but every now and then we keep trying. Some of the other threats that I have, it's because, and once again, this is just talking about where we're at, is aquatic invasive species. We don't really have a lot up here, and we try to keep that out there. And we recently found zebra mussels in the Black Bay area of Rainy Lake, and we're trying to keep them out of everywhere else. But I mean, once they're there, it's inevitable. But not only is it just dangerous for your health, but they eat all those good stuff in the water, and all of a sudden, oh, we have wonderful water clarity. Well, no, that's because the zebra mussels have been eating all the good stuff, which is really detrimental to fish health. And fishing is a major recreational activity up there. And all of this starts to add with climate change, the warming of the water, like I said. The warming of the water is causing fish to swim deeper and deeper and deeper, which is causing them to breed less, which is causing effects to the tourism in the area, and just the fish health in general. Because it's not just tourism that does it. There's, Native Americans and First Nate, they're called First Nations in Canada, that have the ability to net and make a huge profit off that. So a lot of times when you're eating your genuine Minnesota walleye at your restaurant, which you get everywhere, guess where it comes from? And up there, and red, not just up here, but Red Lake and Lake of the Woods and some other places. The other thing we're seeing is, like I mentioned at the beginning, was are these algae, to these toxic algae blooms. And oh God, I have pictures of them just being disgusting. I mean, the water is just green, and there's it's bubbling, and it's just washing up onto shore, and it's awful, and it's toxic. I mean, it'll kill your dog if your dog drinks it. It makes, I don't want to just say recreation impossible, but just a variety of things. Nobody wants to be in that water. you see it, and they're doing more studies, and it's a lot of the studies you're going to see are coming out of Lake of the Woods, which is good because it's the same watershed. They have similar problems, just a different lake. And a lot of the National Park Service scientists are really concentrating on this too, and just looking at what it is and what causes it. Now, what can we do to stop it? Obviously, we need to address climate change on a larger level, like you're talking about with energy usage, which is a big deal. The God, there's so many up there. Where do I keep going? Electric cars and transportation, just being so rural, it's not a big possibility for us to own electric cars, which a lot, I think a lot of people would if they could. So it would be really great to see a lot of those electric cars getting better mileage and not needing charging.
Yeah, I think that we're seeing progress there. For one thing,
We are definitely.
yeah, I was talking to some engineers in an MN350 event about the cold weather conditions. And the
Yeah.
engineer said, if you, and we were talking about trucks, we were talking about small school buses and service vehicles for use, well, things like whatever, even ambulances, but things like public works vehicles,
Right.
cherry pickers and that kind of thing. They make the framework for those things. And they're all their entire customer right now, their only customer right now is Sacramento, which is transferring every single thing over to these vehicles right now, as California generally is doing.
Yeah, they are. 2030, what is it, 2035 is their goal to stop having gasoline powered vehicles.
Right. So I said, what happens if you're in Duluth and you want electric buses and it gets cold up there? And they said, well, we just designed it to work there. How do you do that? Well, there's a battery that takes 10% of your energy, so you get 10% less energy, and it heats itself. So you just put that battery in instead of the other batteries. So there are solutions to these things. And I noticed that, we know we have a friend in common that we worked with, the company that does solar, Native American,
Robert Blake.
Robert Blake. So Robert Blake got this grant, and basically is, let's say you live on the Red Lake Reservation or Leech Lake Reservation or any other northern reservations, and you're Native American, where do you want to go in your car? So they sort of do a survey. Where are you going to go? Well, you're going to go to the Twin Cities, maybe. You're also going to go to Duluth and to various other places. So they made a map and said, we're putting charging stations so that you can do that. So that's not going to be Financial Falls exactly, but it won't take much more to get them up there. We're going to have the charging stations everywhere soon enough.
And you're seeing a few up north. I've seen a few Teslas around that people can just drive around town. And I don't know if we're going to see them in inclement weather or going on long road trips, but it would be great if we could start moving some of that up there because of the fact that, transportation is the number one contributor to climate change in Minnesota, at least,
Right.
is your cars and buses and trucks.
Right.
So one of the other ones, and then let's just talk about some of the other. I mean, this is just a this summer we had a horrible flood. It was a once in a century flood that things happen. But
You
at the
got
end of the day,
personally flooded on that, didn't you?
I had yeah, I went let this will tell you where how much groundwater we have. I'll get there. Is we had a horrible, horrible rainstorm where we got 7 inches of rain, which up north in the rainforest is a lot, but it happens from time to time. But it happened so early in the season that the ground was still frozen. And then, just a series of unfortunate events post that led to the worst flood the area's ever seen, in recorded history. But let's just face it, it's the worst it's ever seen, with climate change happening. I'm not going to say that, 200 years ago when we weren't recording this stuff that it didn't happen, but I'm going to just wager a guess. And this just goes to show you how much groundwater is have. We were able to keep, I live on the lake, Rainy Lake. We were able to keep the lake out of our house because we're on pretty flat ground and we're not even on a floodplain. But the groundwater table was so high that that's what came into our house from the melting ground and the rainstorm is that's what came into my house. So I cut, there was like three little mini rivers just getting into my house from all kinds of directions. And because the groundwater was officially higher than my house, and water always wants to search for the lowest place. And so, I mean, that's just how much groundwater we have.
That's
Is
bad.
it? Yeah.
As I recall, it took weeks for that water to go away, or
It,
months, or
yeah,
weeks,
they
a
said
long
it
time.
took, it, yeah, let's see, it started rising probably in a weird way in mid-May. And I'm like, wow, this is really high. It hit its apex probably in mid-June. And it was when at the end of July, when the water levels start usually start going down, it was about at the highest of what we call the Rule curve.
Okay. So
So
when people think about a flood, like Duluth had a really bad flood a few years ago that hit the zoo and washed all the animals out and stuff. But that was a thing that happened, and then a few days later it was gone. The damage was there. I think most people think
yeah.
of a flood as working like that. This flood took a month and a half to go up and a month and a half to go down.
It was your our slowest, it's probably like one of the slowest moving natural disasters you could think of.
Yeah,
Yeah,
that's just
and
amazing.
yeah, I mean, there's people that are going to be dealing with property damage for a long time with this. And I would say a long time, probably a couple of years. But you know, I mean, ours we're getting together pretty good, and we're figuring it out how to deal with it for the next time it happens. And that's the same thing as I'm not saying if this is happening again. I'm saying the next time it happens, because that's just this is one of the major effects of climate change is these extreme weather events. And we're seeing, you know, warm winter. It's either a horribly warm winter or horribly cold winter. And you know, there's no in between. There's never like a nice normal winter where yeah, we have a few weeks of where it's really, really cold, and then we get a little January thaw. But you know, it's just worse than normal. And there's years we barely see any snow. And there's a lot of people that want to do a lot of winter recreation. They always ha it's getting so bad that normally they could do it closer to home, down in southern Minnesota.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. They're all coming up here because we have snow.
It's like our Minnesota, our famous Minnesota meteorologist Paul Douglas calls it we weather whiplash. So there used to be a pretty big fishing contest on Big Lake, which is down here near Elk
Yep, I know
River.
Big Lake.
Yeah, that fishing contest has not been run for 5 years. They permanently canceled it. I understand they canceled the eel pout contest.
They did. They canceled the EPAL burbot contest on Leech Lake, which is near Walker, Minnesota. It's a
Yeah.
cute town. They canceled it initially because of COVID. The first year
Right.
was they canceled it was because of the pandemic and being close to each other. And then yeah, just a variety of other reasons they've canceled it. So they've done that. And then like yeah, we as far as like the governor's fishing opener goes, it was always risky having it up here. Because fishing, there's a big governor's. The governor goes out on fishing opener, and it's a big thing, and a bunch of people go out, and that's the day that walleye fishing is officially open in Minnesota.
It's like the most important holiday in the state,
Yeah, and
which
it's always it's Mother's Day weekend as
and of course
well.
on Mother's Day, which is the second most important
Yeah, right.
holiday.
And so it was always kind of a risk having it up here as to whether or not the lakes would be open. And the water
Right.
levels would be
Mean
high
from
enough
you
to
mean
go
from
out and put
ice.
the, yeah,
Open being
open from ice. Yeah,
open from
melted.
ice. Yeah.
And
Right.
having the navigational buoys being able to put in, is the water level
Right.
going to be high enough? But now we're kind of like, well, you know, maybe we can. It would still be a risk, but it'd be less of a risk. Most of the time it's open now. And, you know, it's a big tourist area. So we're always looking for a means of economic development and tourist increase, but do it in a conservative way. The conservative friendly way,
And
that because you have to.
one cannot overstate to the non-Minnesotan the importance of walleye fishing. It's like in Vermont and Massachusetts. If you're listening from Vermont or Massachusetts, looking at fall colors, not quite as important as walleye fishing. If you're from Maine, the deer and moose hunts, which everyone engages in, not quite as important as walleye fishing. Because not only is walleye fishing what everybody does, but as you mentioned before, there's an economy based on it. There's a
Yeah.
native economy based on it, and I mean, it isn't, and it isn't just Minnesotans. I mean, Minnesota is flooded not just with water, but with Iowans and Nebraskans, and people from southern Wisconsin come here to do walleye fishing. So
And they
it's
go
a,
up into Canada too.
and they go to Canada too. Actually, the Canadian walleye fishing is a lot better, but it's really important, and it's
It is, yeah.
and the walleye eat a kind of fish that is becoming rare because of climate change effects on that fish.
Right.
And you know their bait fish are dying off because they normally go below they normally go deep into lakes to stay in cold water, and we're just running out of cold water in those lakes anyway. I
Yeah,
think
exactly.
that
We're running out of cold water.
So I mean, there's other issues we could talk about, but we probably have spent enough time on this.
Yeah.
ATVs, pipelines.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, ATVs, pipelines. Pipeline wasn't so much in my watershed.
Right.
It
Yeah.
was next to me and just south of me. But I did a lot of work on that one where there's a line three that was coming in. Another huge line pipeline
Yeah.
that was gonna tap into the not tap into, but increase the amount of crude oil they're pulling out of the Alberta tar sands. And there was, and it was violating treaty law with Native Americans in the area. Most, and they wouldn't settle. So there was a lot of people out there doing the right thing and protesting. And I work as a defense attorney doing a lot of public interest law. I typically work with a lot of mentally ill and chemically dependent people. I had the good fortune of representing 37 of these water protectors last year in court, and I had one of the only acquittals
Well,
in trial. There was a couple what they call, you can look it up, motions for directed verdicts or judgments notwithstanding the verdict, or motions for directed verdict that you put on after the state puts on its case, so the defense doesn't have to because they say the state hasn't met their burden. So there was two or three of those, and then I didn't go that route. I saw the trial all the way through and had an acquittal on a public nuisance charge. So
Great. Yeah, that is something because our pipe, we have more pipelines in Minnesota, more miles of pipeline in Minnesota, even before that line was built,
yeah,
than any
exactly.
other state in the union that doesn't produce oil or gas.
Yeah, it because it they Alberta tar sands, they're just t piping right, pulling them out. And Line 3 was a replacement project. It wasn't a new project, but the new route was really violating a lot of old standing treaties with, especially with the White Earth Nation, that were that this rerouting of it, and all it did was increase the amount of oil that they could pull out of it by, I think, is it 25% or 75%? It was a lot.
Yeah, it was close to doubling. Yeah, something like
Yeah.
that. And yeah,
Yeah.
I had a group that drove me past the pipeline construction,
Oh,
and
it was a mess.
it's a replacement, but it's not a replacement in situ. It's a different.
Yeah,
Most of
and
it's a
that's the
different
thing is,
location.
yeah. Well, yeah, aside from the northern part of it, right, that comes in from the Canadian border, a lot of it was in a different location. And that construction was just a mess. I would drive past it, and as I go south for work, and because I practice law in more counties south of me than I do my own county, and as I was driving, it was just the construction was just a mess, and they had the largest aquifer breach in Minnesota history.
As they put the
And I'll
pipeline
tell you,
through, yeah.
there was a lot of politicians from out of the area that weren't really in this whole mining fight, pipeline fight from up here in the area with this, the same thing of this union jobs versus, or
Right.
just jobs in general versus protecting the environment, and which, whatever, that were like, oh, yeah, I know, it seems like a great opportunity, yada, yada, yada. Last summer happened. Summer of 2021 happened. Yeah, a lot of them were singing a different tune. A lot of them just came. One, and I'm not going to name names, but one that I was talking to this past spring, who was a state senator out of this West Metro, he even just said straight up, "I was wrong." After seeing ha what happened last summer, "You were right. I was wrong."
Pipelines to Minnesota, more jobs for people from Texas.
And that's it. Is They were all coming up from Texas and New Orleans because this is what they do.
Right,
This
that's
is their
where
specialty. There was very few little local jobs made out of this.
there was a time in the past. I'm actually doing a writing project right now that overlaps with the Lovecraft's Call of Cthulhu stories, or a rewrite of that. And in those days, you probably don't, maybe you don't know the story, but one of the things that happens in that early, the origin of horror, the genre, is from this story he wrote. And in the story, young men go off to sea. That's what they did in those days. Whaling or shipping, and one of the boats gets eaten by a monster, right? That's why it's a horror story. And to these days, young men go off to frack or to build pipelines. That's what they
Yeah.
do. And
And
it's a subset of the culture, Oklahoma, Texas, like I said, Louisiana, that's where these men come from mostly, like probably up from everywhere, but mostly that's where the
Yeah,
companies are.
Texas. Most of the ones that came up from and that were working on the Line 3 project last year came from Louisiana and Texas. And I mean, just like let's with the fracking go down to Oklahoma. There's never been earthquakes in Oklahoma before they started fracking there.
That's exactly.
I mean, there's earthquakes in California. I grew up in, or not, I mean, grew up in Nevada, so we'd get the little bit of the earthquakes and some of the aftershocks. But I mean, I spent like 10 years of my adult life in Southern California. We had earthquakes out there because there's on we're on fault lines, they're not on fault lines in Oklahoma. It's just crazy. So, I mean, we don't need to pull more oil out of the ground. And it's been a big argument with people. And some of them, eventually, they just start proving my point of saying, well, there's a lot of weird weather events that have just been happening more and more the past like 10 years. I'm like, yes, I know. I'm well aware. It's not just weird and it's not like a coincidence that it's been the past 10 years. Yeah. So, yeah. And you think that part of it might be that we're pulling too much oil out of the ground? I don't know.
Yeah, if you
I
think
think it
about
is.
it, how much photosynthesis and how many tens or hundreds of millions of years of time that plants, a little portion of the byproduct of what plants do, and some animals
Yeah.
ended up in peat and oil and gas. And we are taking it out at a rate that's like 1,000 times, 10,000 times faster,
Right.
maybe. Well, Megan, thanks. This has been a great conversation.
It has, Greg. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been great working with you on the Environmental Caucus. And thanks for all the work you're doing to help save our planet, our water, and our state.
This is Mike Habrick, and I'm going to talk to Greg Bladen about the Reserve Mining Company case along the North Shore.
I just had a long conversation with Megan Bond. If things go as we expect, listeners to this podcast have heard that conversation already. And now we're moving on to the next topic. And when I talked to Megan, we talked a lot about mining in northern Minnesota. And although we made reference to the earlier iron mining and its importance in the development of the environmental movement, we've mainly focused on copper nickel sulfide mining, which isn't being done now, but it's being threatened to be done in northern Minnesota. And we talk a lot about that. But you have been researching the Reserve Mining Company
Right.
incidents. Why don't you tell us what's that about?
I'll just give you a little bit of background because you referenced the iron mines. But
That'd be
originally,
appreciated.
there were three main iron ranges in northeastern Minnesota. There was the Vermilion Range, the Cuyuna Range, and the Mesabi Range. And they started mining iron in Minnesota in the 1870s. And a lot of the steel for the United States came from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and in the Iron Range in Minnesota. By the 1950s, though, iron was running out in the Iron Range. High quality iron ore that came out of the Vermilion Range had been taken. In the Mesabi Range, there was still quite a bit of iron, but it was tied up in a type of ore called taconite, which is a low grade iron ore. It's not as easy to extract. And so the process for extracting iron from taconite, since it's about 30 to 35% iron and the rest is rock, is to crush it up in really fine dust and take these huge magnets. And then the magnets would take the dust that was iron, and then they would have to do something to dispose of the taconite. These are called tailings because that was pretty much what was left over. It was like the tail end of the process. And in the 1950s, the Reserve Mining Company was a joint venture of three different large iron mine companies. And so, what they had decided to do with the tailings was basically to take them down, and they built this new town called Silver Bay, which is just north of Duluth, probably about 30 miles. And they built this really long chute, and if you drive along the North Shore Drive, when you get to Silver Bay, you'll see this big, long chute coming from a hill at the top of town over towards Lake Superior. And from this is where they would take, and they would run all the tailings, and they would just shoot it straight down into the lake. And in the 1950s, everybody thought this was great because it was a way to preserve jobs in the Mesabi Range, so that the miners that had lost their positions at the Vermilion Range and at the Cuyuna Range, they could move and they could start mining and feed their families. Because this was the main industry in northeastern Minnesota. I mean, there was fishing and camping and hiking and stuff like that, but this is kind of what paid the bills, paid the taxes and all that. So it was really a vital industry. And so it seemed like a good deal for everybody. But then in the early 1960s, there had been like a really great herring fishery in Lake Superior. because they were small fish, they would also feed other fish like lake trout and some of the other things that that we would feed. We would fish, as in the resorts, and also commercial fisheries would take the larger fish. But they were starting to see that the hauls were getting smaller and smaller, and started investigating. And scientists were taking a look down into that area around Silver Bay to see if they could determine what happened. And then the bottom of the lake, they were seeing coatings of materials from the tailings that were preventing the herring from hatching. And so it was killing the herring fishery. And so they started taking their concerns, and it was a classic environmentalist versus the town type of situation where the environmentalists kind of considered wackos that were trying to tell them how to run their lives, and they needed to have their jobs and all that stuff. And so the environmentalists that were raising concern and the fishermen that were raising concerns about what the environmental effects of the tailings were not getting very far until they brought in some people to do water testing to see if there was anything in the water. And they discovered that there was a form of asbestos that was in the water. And so it must have been an element that is the rock, and this part of the rock in the taconite. The thing about it is that back then, Duluth and Superior, which are two large cities right at the very western corner or peak of Lake Superior, for the water supply for the city, drinking water, and what they would take in for laundry and all that kind of stuff, that was coming directly from the lake. It wasn't processed. They didn't have like a water cleaning system like we do in our modern municipal water systems. And so if you open up the tap, the water that had been taken up into the tower and that was dropped down into the line to give you water pressure, it was just coming through the lake. And so they discovered that there was asbestos in the water. Well, this was also at the time that we knew that there was asbestos can cause different types of cancer. And so the researchers took their results and they went to the EPA. And EPA in 1973, I think it was in 1973, the EPA was formed by the Nixon administration.
I think so.
And so they took the results to the EPA, and the EPA went to the Reserve Mining Company and said, well, you're going to give cancer to everybody in Duluth and Superior if you don't find a way to dispose of the tailings a different way. And the Reserve Mining Company said, well, there is no one. We looked at all kinds of alternatives, and there's nothing available. So we have to do this, otherwise people are going to lose their jobs, and we won't be able to build any more skyscrapers. And so then the EPA took them to court in 1973. And there was a year-long trial, and it, was one of those things where it set, there was a judgment, and the judge was Judge Miles Lord. And I remember a lot of this stuff from reading the newspapers when I was a kid. It was like in the Daily Star Tribune. There was always an article about Reserve Mining Company. So by the end of the year, Judge Miles Lord handed out a ruling that said that the Reserve Mining Company had to stop dropping their tailings into Lake Superior. And of course, the Reserve Mining Company appealed it, and the process took about 7 years. There was an alternative site that had been discovered by geologists that would work satisfactorily at a place called Milepost 7. And the EPA proposed this site to Reserve Mining Company. At first, Reserve Mining Company said, no, that won't work. And it's not too far away from Silver Bay. And I'm not sure which road it's on, but it's called Milepost 7. And basically just a pond that they can dump it in. And in 1980, it was finally ruled that this was a satisfactory solution. And both the Reserve Mining Company and the EPA agreed that they could, instead of dropping the tailings into Lake Superior, they could put them in at Milepost 7. And that's basically how that turned out.
So that sounds like it was an important milestone in environmental regulation.
It was actually the first time that a government agency or a federal government agency that actually sued on behalf of the environment and actually made a case and won.
Thank you for downloading and listening to Iconocast, the Science and Advocacy Podcast. I want to let you know that episode 31 is some more conversation between Greg and I on a lot of issues related to the environment, especially in northern Minnesota. So watch for that pretty soon. It'll be episode 31. And thanks again. Share, talk about it, let people know that you like it, and send feedback if you don't. Not sure that I'll do anything about it, but, send feedback. Appreciate it. Thank you.